Yeah, thanks very much to Michael and to Lena for putting this session on. It's very nice for me. I don't get out much these days. I'm very stuck in other places. So it's very nice to talk a little bit about Japan to a wider audience, just my MA class. I've got a very, on the talk of improvisation, I've got a very improvised PowerPoint, which I've put together quite quickly. It's quite short, actually. And I'll just try and talk you through some of the thoughts that I put together yesterday when I was thinking about how to address the topic. I thought the best way to do it really would be to kind of revisit the crisis through revisiting one of my articles that I wrote in 1998. I think it was 1998 or 1999. I wrote an article in I still make my students read it in my MA class. I wrote an article in Wright, Review of International Political Economy, entitled something like Japan and the Financial Crisis, Abject Defeat or Quiet Victory. And really, in that article, what I was trying to do was, I was really trying to sort of, I'm often accused of this of being too pro-Japanese, but I was kind of trying to defend Japan from the sort of onslaught of criticism that it had endured in the wake of the sort of immediate wake of the crisis in 97 onwards. And I was trying to make a number of articles, arguments in that article, sort of small arguments, but I was trying to embed it in a larger argument, which I'll come to. And that's really what I want to revisit, is that kind of larger argument about Japan, which grew out of the sort of smaller arguments about Japan's response to the financial crisis. So what I was trying to do in that article really was to defend Japan in a number of ways. One of the sort of accusations which was levelled against Japan at the time was that it somehow it had caused the crisis. You know, not only had it failed to respond, but it was all Japan's fault because of Japan's devaluation of the yen, because of the domestic depression within Japan's economy, which had really sort of knocked the competitiveness of the ASEAN states on the head and triggered the crisis. And I argued kind of in a sneaky way that, no, actually it was China's fault. It wasn't Japan at all, and it was Chinese devaluation which had actually triggered the crisis. I also tried to defend Japanese analyses of the crisis as well. I mean, the Japanese at the time were very keen to argue that there was nothing fundamentally wrong with the nature of capitalism in East Asia itself. You know, lots of talk about crony capitalism at the time, deficiencies of the developmental state model, and how economies in the region should globalise. You know, the problem was not globalisation, but not enough globalisation was the kind of analysis which came from the West. Whereas the Japanese were arguing very much that really it's simply just a liquidity crisis in 97, 98, and all that really needed to be done was just to pump short-term money back into the regional economy. So I was kind of arguing that I think Japan actually had the right approach, and there was no need to sort of rip up the East Asian development model, and instead to sort of really just deal with that fundamental sort of short-term credit crunch. And the other thing which I was trying to argue was that, you know, that Japan was mounting sort of very quietly a kind of, again, quite proactive. There was a lot of accusation that Japan was simply just sitting on its backside, really, doing nothing. Japanese policymakers simply weren't engaged in trying to respond to the crisis. And what I was trying to argue in that article was that actually Japan was extremely proactive behind the scenes in trying to, in its own way, mount a kind of very quiet resistance to the encroachment of sort of the forces of neoliberalism of the West, of the Washington Consensus and Wall Street Treasury complex, and all that kind of literature that was out there in the late 1990s. So that was partly what the article was about. But as I said, there was a kind of larger, it was part of a sort of larger agenda at the time that I was writing about, which was really regionalism and Japan's position within regionalist projects within East Asia. And a lot of the other writing which went with this Ripe article was trying to argue that what Japan was doing through its response to the crisis was part of a larger story of trying to create essentially or foster an East Asia-centred region in East Asia. And by that, that sounds, you know, obvious, but what I mean is not an Asia-Pacific concept of regionalism which would encapsulate East Asia, but essentially an East Asia-centred vision of regionalism. A vision which was sort of multilateral in conception. i.e. it's not a sort of simply a hub and spokes relationship between Japan and smaller economies, or between the United States and smaller economies, or between China and the smaller economies, but it was essentially a kind of incipient multilateralism. And also, again, you know, that Japan was trying to lead this effort in its own kind of quiet, inimitable style. And I suppose at that time it was kind of a credible argument to make. And under the three kind of, if you might think, sort of components of a more East Asian-centered, multilateral, Japan-led region, you could argue that there was a lot of evidence to suggest that Japan really was. This was a kind of credible argument. So in terms of politics, in the late 90s, we saw the emergence of ASEAN Plus 3, the first all East Asian political dialogue body, excluding the United States. So the first of that, that first kind of framework in the post-war period, in the post-colonial period. In economics, Japan's proposal for the Asian Monetary Fund, which of course was defeated, but nevertheless, Japan carried that effort on through the Chiang Mai Initiative, as its rather central role in the Chiang Mai Initiative, as Peter has talked about. And then in security, of course, Japan was very much bound to the US-Japan alliance because of Japan's particularities in the way that it has to structure its defence and its security policy, so very close to the United States. But nevertheless, Japan was playing a very kind of clever game, which it had played for most of the post-war period, of sort of hedging its security ties with the United States. And at the same time, therefore, it was maintaining good ties with the United States. What it was trying to do was to build some kind of multilateral supplement to that in the shape of the ASEAN Regional Forum. So at the end of the 1990s, going into the sort of new century, you could argue that, new millennium, you could argue that Japan was a kind of good, active regional citizen. And that was kind of what I was trying to argue, and I argued that in a number of publications. However, since just as Japan has been in a kind of long-term depression, I mean, they call it recession and so on, but Japan has been in stagnation for 15, 20 years. Likewise, my kind of view of Japan has also sort of entered into a sort of depression. I find it very hard to tell the good news about Japan, and instead, I have to sort of sell the bad news about Japan. And of course, that sells. Lots of people like to hear the bad news and the critique of Japan. But I find it, in that intervening period since the financial crisis and today, I'm afraid there is lots of what I would view as kind of sort of bad news, or sort of things which you can really critique Japan very heavily in terms of turning back against its own regionalist policy. Maybe I haven't got a lot of time, so maybe, I mean, I could go into these in a bit more detail, but essentially what's happened in that intervening period, in those 15 years, what's happened to Japan? And how has that influenced its regional policy? I mean, the first thing, of course, is Japan has slipped from its position as number two. If you calculated it in GNP, it slipped behind China. And likewise, its own model, I think, of economic development has been seen as less sort of viable for Japan itself, and also less attractive to other parts of the region. So I think there's been a sort of crisis of confidence in Japan itself. And within the region, in Japan as a regional leader. Likewise, Japan has undergone this extraordinarily slow, I'll call it a slow motion regime change in its own domestic political system, political economy. We've seen the exit from the long-running, nearly 50 years or more in power of the Liberal Democratic Party, to finally in 2009, the replacement by Democratic Party of Japan. But this has been an extraordinary kind of slow motion process, which has meant that there's often lacked, Japan has lacked really a consensus around what it should do in the region in terms of a leadership role in the region. Going with that has been a kind of rather disturbing rise at times in Japan of these two trends, or sort of really which have cut against the whole kind of orientation of Japan's post-war diplomacy. Firstly, the rise of historical revisionism, revisiting the colonial past, and of course that's irritated Japan's neighbours. So that's led to Japan in many ways burning its bridges with some of its regional neighbours. And likewise, under the revisionists, really in the last kind of sort of gasps of the LDP administration, the LDP in its desperation turned to the more neoliberal sort of conservative, neoconservative wing of the party, and began to dabble much more in neoliberalism. And actually, very closely, you see the kind of intellectual agendas of these LDP politicians lining up very closely with those of American counterparts. So Japan, in itself, through kind of working through this domestic political change, has actually pursued a number of policies which have alienated East Asian neighbours and moved Japan much closer to the United States in terms of thinking about overall regional and global orientation. I won't say too much about Japan and China's rise, but of course that's been a very problematic relationship for Japan. In many ways it's speeded forward or kept Japanese growth going in certain ways because Japan has been able to invest in China, use it as a production base. It's been an important market for Japan. But at the same time, it's led to worries about asymmetric interdependence, over-reliance on China, and of course a sense of what they call cold politics, a very troubled relationship in terms of, again, historical colonial past and security. Likewise, there's been a transformation of alliance ties with the United States. Again, I can go into detail if anyone's interested. This is what I've been mainly working on the last few years, but Japan has found itself much more embedded within the US-Japan alliance relationship. It's found itself to be a partner in the war on terror, dispatching its forces as far away as the Middle East. And with the Obama administration's recent so-called return to Asia, what Japan has found itself doing is very much linking with US partners like South Korea, Australia, and India, and so on, and rather ignoring or downplaying security relations with any other country in the region which is not a US partner. So Japan has really reinforced that hub and spokes relationship centered around the United States. And then finally, in the domestic political transformation, there's been a sort of collapse of any kind of resistance, I think, to neoliberalism within Japan. You saw the DPJ came into power very briefly in 2009, was promising a more kind of European-style social democracy. That has failed for various reasons, and instead we're beginning to see the kind of recrudescence of the neoliberal elements within the DPJ combined with the neoliberal elements within the LDP. Since in fact they're almost indistinguishable, these two main parties. So last slide. So what has this meant then for Japan's regional policy and my kind of original set of arguments that Japan was going to lead the region into becoming a more integrated East Asian centred multilateral kind of arrangement? Well, clearly, as Peter pointed out in the Chiang Mai Initiative, Japan has remained a good citizen in terms of trying to create these kind of firewalls against global financial flows and crises. But in Japan's larger agenda, it's very striking that Japan's actually discarded much of the sort of earlier concepts of East Asia-centered regionalism. In politics, the DPJ, despite talking about the idea of an East Asian community which would exclude the United States, has largely jettisoned that concept. And now its preferred vehicle for regional cooperation in political terms is the East Asian Summit, which of course crucially now involves the United States. The US is, Japan has very much been on board that agenda of inviting the United States into the region politically, of course to help counterbalance Chinese influence. In terms of economics, again, Peter touched upon this, but Japan has gone very much down, abandoned the multilateral route, and has gone down this rather strange path of a multiplicity of bilateral FTAs, which in many cases I think are doing exactly what Japan was not trying to do in the 1990s, which is to use its leverage on smaller economies in order to cut preferential deals. And most significantly, recently Japan has been talking about joining the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is a very different kind of trading and liberalisation regime from what has existed in the Asia-Pacific or East Asia to date, because it's essentially a closed form of regionalism, it's discriminatory in nature, and of course it's playing very much to a very full, comprehensive liberalisation agenda, not just in trade, but also in finance, in services, which is, in de facto terms, led by the United States. And then finally, in security, as I described before, again, Japan has found itself more and more embedded within the mechanism of the US-Japan alliance, and essentially is reinforcing this hub and spokes model of US military hegemonic dominance in the region. So I guess, you know, my final point is simply to say that 15 years on, the crisis meant a great deal to Japan, but I think Japan has lost many of the opportunities that were created at that time to lead more effectively a particular, more distinctive view of East Asian regionalism. And instead, it's rode back from that, it's lost confidence, and it's found itself much more embedded in an Asia-Pacific vision of regionalism. It's still very much playing to the US agenda rather than a more diverse East Asia agenda.